Bisexual Awareness Week on Pride Radio with NHS Business Service Authority.
It's Bi Visibility Awareness Week with NHS Business Service Authority, and as part of our series of big interviews, I'm talking to prominent people within the bi community. And my next guest certainly ticks that box. Jen Yockney is one of the most prominent bi community activists in the UK, having worked on giving bisexual communities support and a voice for the past 20 plus years. She's the editor of the magazine Bi Community News and co-authored the groundbreaking Bisexuality Report, which we'll talk about today. Jen was awarded an MBE in 2016 for services to the bisexual community. Hello there, Jen. Are you all right?
Hello. Lovely to meet you.
And, you know, I'm desperate to ask, forget the Bisexuality Report. Who was your royal? Who got to pin the little badge on you?
That's really weird because it was Princess Anne.
Oh, I like Princess Anne. She's my favourite.
That in itself wasn't the weird bit. It was, you remember the LGBT History Month, February 2020, just before lockdown and
yes,
the world changed. I was speaking at a number of events for, you know, some of the hubs where they were having lots of talks and presentations and displays and so on around the north of England. And I suddenly realised everyone there who was saying, and our work got recognised or visited by this royal, every single time it was Princess Anne. So she's clearly cheerleading for us very discreetly. As a result, you kind of like, you're all, oh, what's your princess? What did she say to you? Because it's like, we've all met the same one. Bit weird.
Well, that's my next question to you. Do you know, I always wondered, you know, she's got a lot of pins to put on people, you know, and I imagine somebody's whispering in her ear, you know, this person does this and this person does that, and she'll have a good lengthy chat if she likes the subject and probably, like, shoes you on if she has no idea what you're on about. Obviously, without breaking state secrets, did she seem, you know, genuinely interested in your work, or was it very much, oh, we shall have fog by tea, isn't the weather nice?
No, not. There was no fog by tea. It was in particular because when you get the honours, sort of the notification, the Prime Minister is minded to give your name to Her Majesty and would you be willing to accept, sort of thing, as a discreet letter in the post that says, if you tell anyone about this, then it's not happening, sunshine. When you get that, they put down my details as someone who's a trans woman who lives the gender through quite a genderqueer expression of it. Mm-hmm. It says, and I got my name correct, and then for the title, it said Ms. MS, and I was like, that's perfectly good.
Cool.
That's, you know, plenty enough recognition of my gender journey, but... Yeah. And I kind of had a tossing and turning for trying to decide, because I slightly prefer the non-binary title Ms. MS. And, of course, that's something which had never appeared in sort of, you know, proclamations from the palace before. People on the internet will still tell you it's a made-up thing that's just been invented and therefore it's not real. Uh-huh. And do I send back the form as it is, because it's asking for corrections? Do I cross out the S and write in an X and try and get a sort of a win, not just for a first and unique recognition of bisexual community work? There'd never been anything that was specifically for the B previously.
Yeah.
But also to get that in there for people who are non-binary and genderqueer to get an acknowledgement that way as well. Which you've got the risk of the Queen saying, nope, that's going too far, you're not having it.
Of course.
And slept on it because making an instant decision felt like it would be rash. Decided, the hell, I'm going to go, you know, try and get the extra mile.
Yeah.
And so... one of the things that happened as part of this was, obviously, they accepted, you know, the non-binary title. That was fantastic. When I arrived at the palace, you'd have me sort of taken to waiting sort of, fantastic palatial rooms until your honours are being presented. And everyone treated me with exactly the same respect as they did any of the other recipients, which was fantastic, because I've been quite nervous about it.
Of course, actually. Of course.
And the only difference was one of the palace staff took me to one side and said, I don't know if you're aware of this, but the medals come in male and female versions. We've prepared both, and if you could just let us know which one you would rather receive.
Oh, how sweet.
which, yeah, you know, in terms of an ancient archaic institution trying to accommodate something that doesn't fit its template. You couldn't get better than that. You know, they're not going to invent a new medal just for me.
No. Not yet, anyway.
Well, you know, when I've achieved a couple more things, maybe. But no. But so I said, oh, I'd rather have the female one. That would feel, you know, the more comfortable of the two.
Cool.
And so that was what I was presented with. And I think when you say about, you know, there's someone who sort of whispers into the royal ear, yeah, of this one is for such and such, and you've met them before when they got such and such an award or whatever. As a result, my conversation was kind of about her reflecting back to me how that had pushed a boundary, and it could have gone, it, you know, that is a difficult decision to make.
Of, wow,
if you can get this far and achieve this much, or do, yeah, you try and go the extra mile? And that was the little conversation. The other thing I'd say with what you said about it, my observation after I'd received my award, because then you sit down in the hall and applaud everyone else and, yeah, so on, but also of friends who I had who came along with me for it and were sat there watching, everyone got the same amount of attention. It didn't matter if you were getting the lowliest sort of, you know, lowest ranking medal that was being presented, or if you were getting a, you know, much better than me, shiny CBE sort of, yeah, thing. Everyone got the same amount of love and attention, which I think for me, that was really quite heartening as well.
Yeah, it's as important as the award.
People there who, it's, you know, it's your fourth time at the palace and the third time that you've received a gong, and,
yeah,
oh, it's you again, hello, how are you doing? Almost sort of feeling. Versus for someone like me, that's the only time that's ever going to happen in, yeah, our lives. You know, 25 years ago, when I started volunteering with bisexual projects, Section 28, the ink was still wet on the paper for, yeah, that becoming law, pretty much. You know, it was not a, this is a route that gets you to meet a princess sort of thing. But it was kind of like, all of you, this is an incredibly special day for you. And without that sort of slice of, you've not got as big and fancy a thing, or you're not one of my mates,
yeah,
sort of thing. You know, it was for an institution where it's hard to use the word egalitarian, it was impressively egalitarian. So.
And sorry, before we come on to the report, it's almost kind of answered my next question, because I'm fascinated for you personally. Obviously, we're here to talk about Bi-Awareness Week. What, you know, you've been working in this sphere and being an ambassador and championing for 20 plus years, probably more. What changes have you seen for better or for worse? There's a good example of something that could be better. You know, that's there you are. You're being recognised for the work that you've done. You know, 50 years ago, you know, or certainly back in the 70s when I was a kid, it wouldn't have been heard of. Probably in the 80s, it wouldn't have been heard of either. So that's a positive. What other things have you sort of like seen in societal change, or that's not gone the way that you'd hoped?
I mean, mostly when I think about the B, and obviously as someone who's also the T strand, yeah, LGBT, sometimes these things, you know, they overlap. None of us are sort of independent, discrete boxes of identity. You don't have a day where you're just living your experience as being white, or just living your experience of being 5'9" or whatever.
Yeah.
We're all of these things all at the same time. When I try and think about specifically the B side of it, it has been, as you say, a little bit more than 25 years now. Every time I stop and do the maths of when I first got embroiled in doing these things, which I think is 1993, is where I would probably draw the line, as that was where I first started volunteering with things.
You must have been just six at the time. That's what it is.
I mean, this has aged me terribly. You know, when I started doing this, which feels like barely a fortnight ago, I was, you know, in my 20s, and now terrible things have happened. It's a terrible aging thing, this doing something for a quarter of a century. But back then, compared with now, in terms of the B, the things that have changed, particularly as someone, you know, running a social support group, and so you see what people want to talk about, because people come along, they've got stuff on their mind, you know. I'm finally, for the first time in my life, I'm in a room with 20, 25 other people who are bi or pan or whatever,
yeah,
and the things that I can talk about, sometimes the things that you don't even realise have been an issue.
Yeah.
One of the best backhanded compliments that I ever got running the support group was someone who said, coming along to Biforia has been brilliant. I never realised how unhappy I was until I was here. Which is the most terrible, you know, you don't want to put that on as your advertising slogan. But if you live the whole of your life surrounded by biphobia, if every partner you've had to make that decision of when do I come out to them, if I do mention things about past partners or other people who I fancy on the TV or whatever, does that cause tension and stress in the relationship? In some cases, you know, is that the moment where they start throwing crockery and yelling at me about how I need to sort my head out and pick a team or those sorts of things? You get to see an enormous shift over time in some of those things. So you go back to the 1990s and it's like you would get a character on a TV show who was the bisexual, and we kind of cling to them because they were the bisexual on TV this year, and they would be the subject of conversation for months and months and months. And now, so many more channels, so many more programs, and a lot, not always necessarily positive bisexual representation, but a lot more bisexual representation than we ever had. So you can go, oh, there's this, and it's brilliant. It's the first time I've really felt that I connected with a character, and people go, yay! And then they suggest three other programs that are on at the moment that you might also want to try, or that you can easily pick up on a streaming service if it's been out for a few months or a couple of years. And we never had that richness of representation. I remember about 10, probably more than 10 years ago now, back in the 1990s, you remember Basic Instinct?
I do indeed.
Sharon Stone playing bisexual serial killer and kind of like mocking this and saying to someone, yeah, it's amazing the progress we've had. We've been able to go all the way from serial killers to serial monogamists. We still don't really have a rich, diverse representation, but now we're allowed not just to kill people, but sometimes just to break up their relationship.
Yeah. Can we not just run the laundrette down the road and just be really nice and normal, you know? We don't need this depiction on TV all the time.
Exactly. I mean, it is massively improving over time, but I think an awful lot of show writers still kind of like the only way that they think they understand how to represent a bisexual on screen is to show someone cheating or someone being confused. And it's that kind of tip of the iceberg of real bisexual experience where 90% of us, that's not where we are or, you know, the important bisexual story of our lives. But that's the thing that's almost the visual, and therefore I think TV and film people, that's the easy thing to do. Whereas showing someone, I don't know, waving a bisexual flag on a parade or trying to work out, oh, I've got a stash of bisexual magazines, I'm dating someone new, how do I hide these things? Do I come out first? How you navigate some of those things are a little bit, perhaps not telegenic enough, but are much more kind of where people's actual bisexual experiences are by and large. Hit me up with another question. No, I've remembered where we were going with that, which was what else has changed.
It's,
so my apologies.
It's all right, you know, it's a very fluid conversation, this. You know, we've gone from Princess Anne now to talking about serial killers. You know, that's what I like about these podcast interviews. You never know where you're going.
Well, that's a link that's guaranteed they never give me another medal. So you have that change in television. You also have change in kind of like the lobbying, political sphere, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Where if I go back those years, when I first came out onto the Manchester gay scene, we had bars that had no bisexuals door policies, and that was considered perfectly okay. You had things, you know, big gay organisations that didn't include the B, sometimes in a passive way, sometimes quite actively. So, for example, the trade union Unison has what's now LGBT Unison, in those days was called Lesbians and Gays in Unison.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you came out as bisexual, you weren't allowed to be a member. The fact that you might be, say, a lesbian and a bi woman working in the same office in a relationship, getting abuse from co-workers who have found out about that and have prejudice, Lesbians and Gays in Unison would say, we will support the lesbian, but we won't support the bisexual because she has special magic privilege and isn't being hurt by the homophobia or biphobia involved. And that mental journey has overwhelmingly happened for LGBT sort of like campaigners, organisers, that sort of thing, in a way that really wasn't the case back in the 80s and 90s. And there needed to be a chunk of learning and understanding. I think we might come on to the bisexuality report, which is an important part of how that journey happened. So things like that have changed enormously. There are now far more representation, far more voices speaking up as allies. infinitely more. I mean, you look at the statistics over time of how many people from each sort of generation feel that they can be out as bisexual, and that has been a massive march and progress that is fascinating to see and to consider what some of the reasons behind it are. But equally, as someone running a support space, there's things that are still the same, and the important thing that still is the same is that moment of personal crisis where you go, oh God, I'm bisexual, I've just worked out what this thing is. What does it mean for me? What does it mean for my partner? What does it mean for my past experiences as I reinterpret them? What does it mean going forward for what stereotypes and assumptions people might have about me if I'm starting to date them or if I come out to co-workers or those sorts of things? And that kind of individual human moment of what does this mean and how is this going to affect me and the people I love, that is exactly the same now as it was back in 1994.
So many subjects to come in there, but I know they're covered in the bisexuality report. So let's go to that now. I know you've been published in a lot of publications and produced your own work. This was a co-authored work. How did it come about, the bisexuality report?
So this takes us back to 2010 and the formation of the coalition government between the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives. And, you know, prior to that, for countless years, we had had single-party government. So someone makes a decision of this is what we're going to do about XYZ policy area, and you sort of, you know, chug your way through that. But having two parties who have been at loggerheads with each other for 350 years or something meant that things had to be written down because they wouldn't just trust each other's good word. And so, start of 2011, they published a thing called the LGBT Action Plan for what the coalition government was going to do about lesbian, gay, bi and trans people's experiences, improving their health outcomes and all sorts of stuff like that. And as an activist, this thing got launched. It got launched in Manchester, which was very convenient for me. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, this is brilliant. We've actually, because, you know, if you're working with small groups that can't afford to have staff lobbying in Parliament and so on, then this set out, you know, what, I forget what things were, but let's say, you know, in March 2012, we will begin consulting about LGBT people's experiences in sport. And you could go, okay, so if we might want to have something to say about that, we can plan ahead and be in a position where we can say something rather than it just, oh, there's a law that's just been passed. It all happened too quickly for us to be able to respond. But when you open that report, it said, these are the ways that lesbians and gay men experience homophobia and how it damages them and what we ought to do about it. And this is the evidence base. And these are the ways that trans people experience transphobia and oppression. And these are the ways that we propose to do to address that. And it had the word bisexual on the cover. And I think you're getting a little bit of the disdain that I had in that moment.
Yes. I'm feeling it.
Already. Because it's kind of like you've got LGBT on the cover, inside you've got an L, you've got a G, you've got a T. It's really nice to see all of them in there and that set has plans. But except there was this basic problem, which was when you went to the back of the report, it cited all of its references, what publications, what research there was that was the reason why the government was proposing to do what it would do. Uh-huh. Brilliant evidence-based policy making. I love that as a concept.
Yeah.
The thing was, as a bisexual activist, I knew if those civil servants had come to me and said, we've got these brilliant publications from Stonewall, who in those days really only ever talked about lesbians and gay men.
Yeah.
We've got this research evidence base from Press for Change, which is kind of the equivalent trans organisation in stature of the time. Where's the evidence base about bisexual experience? How is it different for bis? I would have gone, can I get back to you in a couple of days? Because there wasn't something, although I, you know, as looking after bi community news as a magazine and as a website, I knew that there was lots of research out there. I'd done, you know, work helping the then Biblio network for academics working on and around bisexuality to try and get them to share research findings back to the community better than had been happening previously. But there wasn't one place that I could point to and say, right, if you want to know how it's different for bis, here's this, you know, 20-page document, 40-page document, whatever, here is, the evidence base for what is different and why and what you should therefore do. And that kind of takes some of the wind out of your sails when you're being angry at someone for not having bothered to read something that didn't exist.
Exactly.
So I went away from that, thought about it, thought about how to present that information usefully, cobbled together some people from various academic circles and so on, and said, look, I've got this idea. We need a report that kind of does this and this and this that looks at, and was really going for, and this is very much the shape of what we wind up with, something where you could go along to your local police and say, biphobic hate crime hurts bi people. There are subtle ways in which it's different than homophobic hate crime. This is the evidence base. Look at, you know, read pages 13 and 14. If you're going along to your local mental health services, this is how we have worse mental health outcomes than both straight people and lesbian gay people. You need to do something about it. The evidence base is on pages 17 and 18.
And how did you find that evidence? Was it a case of looking at other studies that had been done? Was there focus groups, surveys, etc.? Or how did it all come together so you could have that moment where you'd say, for mental health, you need to look at page 23?
This is the joy of getting people who are actually academics and have access to all those kinds of research papers embroiled in the project, in a way that if I'd done this on my own, I would never have been able to, because so much of it is kind of behind university paywalls and academic publisher paywalls of things. So it wasn't new research.
Right.
It was taking all the research that was out there, but that was squirreled away in odd little places. And maybe we'd done, you know, my Community News' research section had a little thing about, there's been something that shows such and such, like, for example, one of the things that I still find amazing, you know, the pay gap.
Yes.
We all know, lots of us know about this in terms of gender. There's the sort of, you know, on, let's say, November the 18th or something each year, like for like, effectively, women stop working because the amount less on average that you earn because of your gender is so significant, it's as though you're only working for 11 months of the year instead of 12. There's a sexuality pay gap as well. And for bisexual people, they come out worse out of gay, straight, lesbian, and bi. For bisexual men, the pay gap is so big, it actually removes the entire income advantage of being a man from the equation, if you're out of bisexual at work, statistically on average. So amazing things like this, but they're all squirreled away in odd corners. They're not in one place. So the thing was taking, okay, here are half a dozen policy areas that it would be useful to be able to lobby public services or, you know, local councils, businesses that you're working for, to explain what they need to do on some of their equality and diversity work, all those sorts of things, and put what evidence there was wherever we could in the UK. Unfortunately, because we were doing this with research that had been published up until about 2009, mm-hmm. You know, the evidence base now is stronger in the UK than it was back then. But so for some things we were having to go, okay, there is, after good intention, we can find nothing that actually gives decent evidence about this in the UK. But we can tell you, in America, this is how it works, and in Canada, this is how it works, and there are probably very similar outcomes or issues here based on, you know, people's lives being reasonably similar. So that was an amazing document to have. And like I say, one of those things where I had this vision, but I needed a bunch of academics to actually do the, can you get at all of this stuff that the rest of us cannot? But that presented for a lot of organisations that up until then there had been this idea, the sort of the received wisdom when I came out at the end of the 80s, when I found, you know, the gay scene in Manchester and those sorts of things, of bisexuals are kind of, you know, gay light, half gay.
Yeah.
So they're not as oppressed as lesbians and gay men. They get it easier. They get this kind of hall pass privilege thing whereby, you know, homophobia doesn't impact them as much because often they may be in mixed gender relationships and so be read as straight, even though they're not. And in those days, I always found it a bit of a weird idea because, you know, on the occasions where unfortunately I've been queer bashed, no one ever, you know, corners me in an alleyway, pulled out a clipboard, did a little checklist on me to find out how into men or women I was, and then said, well, you come out as a 3 on our results, so we're just going to beat you up down the left-hand side of your body and leave the right-hand side of your body untouched. That's not how any of that actually works in reality. It's just a weird idea. And as we've learned over the years to talk about the impact of homophobia, for example, in the workplace, of how not being able to be out and fully yourself means people work less well because they're spending a chunk of time not opening up about their lives, watching their language, not feeling that they can socialise as much with the rest of the team, all those kinds of things. And so that negatively impacts how well you perform at work. And it's been the whole business case for doing LGBT inclusion in the workplace has been your workers will be happier and more efficient and all those sorts of things.
Sorry,
I've just lost my thread.
I could sit and listen. There's lots of things that have come from what you've said. First of all, that there was all this information already out there, but nobody really knew what to do with it or did anything with it. Some fascinating facts come from the report, and you put it all together, and it's 49 pages of a really interesting read. But then what happens? You know, sometimes with reports, we've done a report that says tick the box, let's put it on a shelf, and then what shall we do next? What happened with the report then? Was it a case that we've got this amazing all this academic information, was there then a campaign to lobby Parliament to do an education exercise? Because it sounds like what lacked prior the report was education, was an understanding that, you know, if you actually were nicer to bi people in the workplace, they'd work more, better for you. If you actually, had a reporting system for attacks, then more bi people will come forward and share experiences. What did you do with the report?
So that's one of those things where I have to say, not just me. Yeah. Really big time, not just me. Loads of people picked this up and worked with it in different areas. To a certain extent, there was also a useful moment in time there where Ben Summerskill, who had been the head of Stonewall up until that point, stepped down and was replaced by Ruth Hunt. Yeah. And that almost gave a bit of an opportunity of, okay, we're going to have a fresh conversation now, because Stonewall had not always been a great friend to the bisexual community in some of the work that it had done. And that was kind of like, okay, we can start here, and this is a different page. So that gave an evidence base for people who were in all sorts of organisations to go, here is something, here is the basis of, here is a set of evidence about how things are different. And it's not just me being one pissed off, angry bisexual. It's something the Open University published it, which was brilliant because that gave it that kind of
gravitas.
It's not, it's not a bunch of shaggy people. It's an academic report coming from a well-known and respected institution rather than, some bunch of bisexuals on Canal Street say sort of thing. And so that kind of gave us both in going out to organisations that wanted to do LGBT inclusion, here is something presented in the way that you will understand. Because that thing of being able to go to your town hall, being able to go to your local health service, etc., go, here is the evidence, it's from a source that you will have some respect for, and this is the section that says, this is what's different, this is what you need to do. And that, to me, that was kind of the step change point.
Yeah.
That saw from there a lot more organisations, because in a way, up until then, as bisexual activists, we've been, cross about things, we've been shouty to each other about things, but we haven't really done the going and speaking to them in their language instead of going and speaking to them in our language. And if you want to persuade people in those kinds of positions of power to change things, that's the sort of almost the compromise that you have to make.
Yeah.
Is that, we would like the moon on a stick. However, we believe that you could achieve giving us a slice of moon cheese on a platter that would get us part of the way there, and you understand how to deliver moon cheese. So could we have some moon cheese, please?
See, I love these conversations. Now we're on to moon cheese. You never know where it's going to go when we have a chat on the big interview. What do you think? I mean, listening to what you said, you know, and taking it all in, the big thing that's coming across is there seems to be a confusion about bisexuality. We kind of understand what a lesbian is to some extent, and a gay, and a trans person. But growing up, certainly, you know, I was born in 71, so being around bisexual people, you know, we had the stereotypes of what a gay and lesbian was. We didn't really know what a trans person was. But growing up, you know, we had that in our head. Bisexuality, for me, was an easy way to tell my friends when I was a teen that I was actually gay, but it was a stepping stone. You know, I knew I was gay, but, you know, saying bi was kind of like, I've still got one foot in the other camp, you know, so please don't hit me any harder. Is it that there's just a confusion that we don't understand what being bi is?
I think confusion is a really interesting word to use there, because one of the old bisexual slogans that I came across back in the 1990s when I was first getting involved in these things was, no, I'm bisexual, you're confused.
Yeah.
Because so often, I mean, I think going back to the idea of bisexuality, if you like, picture an iceberg, and the bisexuals that you see are that little tip of the iceberg above the waterline. Because if, as most of us do, you know, if you're not having conversations about their sexual orientation with them on a regular basis, then you meet someone and you find out that this is Bob and he's got a wife called Susan. And your brain puts both of them into a box labeled heterosexual without thinking about it very much. If I was born in 73, so exactly the same kind of sort of understanding culture of sexuality whilst growing up. And you need almost to consciously own the B word over and over again, because if you are in a monogamous relationship, or if you are single, then people make assumptions based on who you're with or who they've most recently seen you with and put you in a box. And if you said you were bisexual a while ago, but you haven't mentioned it for 2 years, then there's a tendency to put you into one of those gay or straight boxes similarly, in a, oh, you were bisexual a while ago, but you just seem to be being a bit confused. Actually,
yep.
Confusing. Seems to be being a bit confused, and now, oh, look, you're dating girls, so you picked a team, sort of thing.
Yeah, you're not being greedy anymore. That's what I used to get.
we'll come back so greedy to me again in a moment, and we'll come back to that one. But it's the problem of my mum. Right.
Yeah.
I came out as bisexual when I was to my family when I was 18 and a half, 19, that sort of age. But I came out first to my big sister, and she'd come to visit me. I was at university, and I did that kind of like conversation over a meal. And lots of us, if you're listening to this podcast and you've come out, you'll remember one of the first times you came out probably went a bit like this, where it starts with you saying, I'm not going to be home for Christmas quite when I was originally planning to, because I'm going away with the... And then you start kind of hiding your mouth with your hand and vanishing your head down into the food in front of you rather than making eye contact. As I'm going away with the lesbian gay bisexual society from the University of Sydney. And to summarise the next 10 minutes of conversation, my big sister replied to me with, oh, you're bisexual. Oh, right. So am I.
Wow.
So's Mark. So's Mum.
Wow.
And you're there going, I've known this for 2.5 years myself. I've been out to a bunch of people in my life, but not to my family, because that is, you know, one of the scariest comings out that you can do. But because we weren't a family that, like, was very emotionally demonstrative, we weren't a huggy family or that sort of thing. And because my sister was more than 10 years older than me, so living away and, you know, stuff that had happened to her while she was working out her sexuality, I've been too young to understand what any of it was at the time, sort of thing. You're there, you know, every so often you're having Sunday lunch and there's five of you sat round a dining table and four of you are bisexual and you haven't worked out that if it came down to a straight fight between the queers and the not queers, we'd win by a massive margin because we've got the numbers. We have this thing of bisexuals being invisible because the only bisexuals that we tend to recognise are either the person who is having sex with lots of partners, whether simultaneously or in close succession, of different genders, or the person who is actively talking about it because they've just started working out that they're bisexual and they're trying to work out what that means for them, for their relationships, for who they were in the past, for what this means for their future, whether they're really bisexual, because so many of us get told, you're not bisexual really, you've got a preference, and that's the same thing as only really liking one thing.
Yeah.
Now, I prefer ice cream to pizza, but anyone who could see me sitting here recording this podcast would be able to look at my belly and say that I was definitely quite committed to both of those things, really. I like both of them. In the case of ice cream and pizza, I will go so far as to admit I'm not really into having them at the same time. Anything else about my life, you're going to have to buy me a drink before I tell you.
Uh-huh.
But that's who we see as being bisexual. We don't see... So my mum, because we were talking about my family, my mum had late-night drunken conversations with my big sister. Unfortunately, she died when I was still comparatively young in my 20s, so we didn't get to have those conversations directly ourselves. But she was born in the 1930s. She met a guy when she was about 17, got married, had kids, was, you know, faithful and monogamous. Nothing ever happened with people of any other gender in her life. To your average academic recording that, they'd go, oh, straight woman.
Yeah.
To any of her friends who she never had that kind of late night drunken, well, if my husband died then ... sort of conversation, she was a straight woman. You needed to have that conversation and you need to respect that someone's description of their own attractions is real and that they know what they feel better than you do.
Yes.
To be able to go, yeah, you really are bisexual. You just happen to have met someone who worked for you. You got lucky with that early on in your life, so you didn't have all sorts of other relationships that people who go, well, how do you know? If you've never been with another woman, how do you know you're really bisexual? Well, you know, because you keep thinking these things about how hot girls are, and you talk about them in ways that your straight friends kind of don't.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that you said their attraction, because when anything with gay, lesbian, trans, or however you identify, it's always sex. Oh, that's the person you sleep with. And it's kind of like, no, it's the person I'm attracted to. It's the person who I'd like to love, you know. But certainly, you know, when we've discussed with some allies that have sort of like strange ideas about that we're all having these mass orgies and whatnot because that's what we do, it's not about who we sleep with as such, it's who we love or feel attracted to.
I have never received a rebate on my income tax for having to buy a sturdier bed. It's just one of those things.
Well, but, you know, the new Prime Minister's coming in on Monday, maybe that could be a tax write-off.
Yeah, whichever one we get, they might be needing a few extra policy ideas. I'll just jot it down in a little note to the Treasury. There's that, you're absolutely right, that there is that thing that we are seen only as our sexual sex lives,
yes,
rather than this is an element of so much else, you know, that way that, oh, if you tell children in school about the existence of lesbian, gay, bi and trans people, then you're sexualizing them. But if you tell them that mummy and daddy have had a fight and they're sleeping in different bedrooms now because mummy's very cross with daddy, that's not sexualizing them at all. That's perfectly normal family life. That's a weird double thing, isn't it?
You know, it is.
Because that's everything there, really, compared to, oh, yes, you know, Susie in your class has got two daddies. Contains far less sexual information than what I just described about a hypothetical straight situation.
Exactly.
What things did we touch on there? Sorry to do something that needs to be edited out. You mentioned...
I was just saying it's about love and attraction and how, you know, people seem to be always, like, confused about us because it's all that you have to sleep with that person or you have to sleep with that person. And I've got girlfriends, and they you know, two people who identify as women. One identifies as a lesbian. The other one identifies as bi. They've been married for 4 years. They've been together for 15 years. They've got a totally monogamous relationship. It's just the one person who identifies as bi finds the opposite sex attractive. Doesn't mean that they want to sleep with them, doesn't mean that they want to do anything, because they're perfectly happy in this relationship, but they're open to the fact that they have attractions to other people. My lesbian friend is just attracted to women, and that's how they kind of live their lives. And when they try and explain that to people, I mean, though you shouldn't have to explain yourself to anybody, but even to me, when I first met them, I was confused by it. I went, wow, this, you know, quick, get the cheese and wine out. This is going to be a good half hour conversation. But it does just boil down to, at the end of the day, that people are allowed to be different. They're allowed to live their lives the way that they do. And as long as nobody's getting harmed and the people around them are supportive, then it's as simple as that, really. Or is that too simplistic?
I mean, it should be as simple as that. And I think there's an interesting thing in there where you've said one of them is attracted to only to women, one of them is attracted to people of more than one gender. We haven't said how many people either of them is attracted to, because that might be, to create a couple of stereotypes, not knowing your friends about them, but that might be a lesbian who's attracted to every second woman she sees on the high street,
yeah,
and a bisexual who's attracted to one person in 10,000. And generally, people, you know, I don't care what they've got between their legs, I tend not to fancy them anyway.
Exactly.
We see, because the only bisexuals that we recognise are those ones who are actively owning the label, actively talking about it, or in, you know, who we're perceiving as being in multiple relationships and so on with people of more than one gender. We don't see that bisexual as bi because she's not obviously being attracted to many people.
Yeah.
She's invisible. And then we have the, well, if you're bisexual, then you must be greedy.
Yeah.
And that you're almost, because we only see the sex life thing, we don't see the rest of the person. And yet I think about, you know, the greed thing. And where it always takes me is that, Lord help us, that old Woody Allen one-liner about the great thing about bisexuality is it immediately doubles your chance of a date on a Friday night. Now,
not necessarily.
It was in the 1970s. It was a, if I can put it that way, it was a good level of bisexual awareness for a joke in the 1970s.
Yeah.
But we've moved on a bit, as indeed many of us have from particularly admiring Woody Allen, perhaps. But the thing about it is, for me to have a successful date on a Friday night, you need to be potentially into me as well.
Yes.
And in a world where, let's imagine, let's pretend for a moment there aren't, that you're the only bisexual in the world, right? Everyone else, something like 90% of the world are straight, 10% of the world are gay. So if you're a bisexual woman and you've got 10 men to pick from, 10 women to pick from, according to that Woody Allen rule, then, oh, look, so by being bisexual instead of straight, you've gone up from a dating pool of 10 people to a dating pool of 20 people. You've doubled your chances of a date. Fantastic. Except 9 out of those 10 men are into women and the other one isn't.
Mm-hmm.
But only 1 in 10 of those women are into women and the other 9 aren't interested. So no matter how much you might say, do you want to go on a date? You're really hot. You're amazing. Fundamentally, they're just not going to be into you.
So. Yeah.
And maybe you haven't increased your chance of a date to double, you've increased it by maybe 10%. Except then, because of social biphobia, because people have been told from friends, from the media, from, you know, basic instinct telling you don't go to bed with a bisexual, she'll go at you with a pickaxe, and all those sorts of things. Quite possibly, we've knocked 3 of the men who are going, I'm not dating a bisexual, I've seen films, they're all psychotic. And the woman has been told if you date a bisexual, she'll leave you for a man because you can't trust them. So she's going, I'll never date a bisexual either. You've come out as bisexual. You haven't doubled your chances of a date on a Friday night. You've cut them in half.
Sounds like a Netflix series I'd subscribe to. But equally, you know, as a gay man, you know, you come out to a group of friends and they go, oh, backs against the wall, lads. And it's like, no, I don't fancy any of you. But bless you for thinking that, you know.
It's it's never the attractive ones who think that you must fancy them when you come out, is it?
Because that's what we are. It's all about sex. We're going to come to the end of our chat, though I could talk to you for hours. What are your hopes? It's Bi Awareness Week, you know, and there's going to be Bi Awareness Day. What are your hopes? You know, using all the experience that you've had, you know, working particularly with the bi community, seeing the changes that have been made for the positive, hopefully, and the reports that have been published and so on. What are you hoping going forward?
I mean, I think I've described that almost in the journey of Bi Visibility Day on September the 23rd, which starts back in 1999, and I've got a particular personal attachment to it because way back then it was celebrated in three countries in the United States and South Africa, and I organised the only thing in Britain to mark the date, and have gone on to run BiVisibilityDay.com, the website with listings all around the world. And every year, it grows bigger.
Yeah.
There have been particular moments where you get quite, you know, amazing breakthroughs. The first time that there was a meeting at the White House about how things were different for bisexuals, that was quite a, oh my word, kind of moment compared to how things had started out. The first time that a British government minister sent a message of support back in 2013, that was a post the bisexuality report moment of we are starting to reach into parts of government in people understanding that these things are different, and that people need to make services suitable to the people who are receiving them. But what I see there is year on year, more countries are marking Bi Visibility Day, be it at a government level, at people organising a party in a bar, at universities and public buildings flying the bisexual flag, businesses having maybe a bake sale, selling cakes to fundraise for a local bisexual group, or those sorts of things. Every year it grows that bit bigger. Now, there are those people who then take that and draw the line and say, so, it, you know, 1% of people identified as bisexual 10 years ago, 3% do now, and in the year 2100, everyone will compulsorily be bisexual whether they want to or not.
Hooray.
And I don't think that the curve actually does that. I think in the same way that when we used to, you know, hit kids with a ruler for writing with their left hand in order to train them to be right-handed whether they were or not, I think that what we're seeing is a rollback of all the stuff that made people feel they had to pretend to be someone they weren't, or that the feelings they were having weren't real enough to be able to seek validation and be honest about them. And I think somewhere along the line, we hit some number. I'm not going to give you a number of what it will be, but we'll hit some kind of number where that almost levels off and just becomes, this is the natural rate in society where if people feel they can be honest about themselves, their past, their present, their ideals for the future of who they'd like to be, that they can honestly be, this is me and I'm straight or I'm gay or I'm bi or I'm asexual, and that's great. And also that this label is something that I will use for as long as it helps me. And then if I want to put it down and pick up a different one that feels a more honest description of who I am now, that it'll be a safe world in which to go, yeah, I was whatever, you know, I was a lesbian, but I'm bi now. That feels the better word to use for it. I was straight. I've worked out that actually there's all these other people who I just never understood that I was crushing on because I'd always assumed that I was straight.
Yeah.
And now I see the world through a different set of eyes, and that has freed us up. You know,
well,
if all the work of the gay liberation movement from the 50s, 60s forward means anything, it's not simply about getting people to be able to be free to be gay and lesbian. It's about getting everyone free to be able to be honest about who they have been and who they feel they are right now.
And there you are, being honest about yourself. That's the important thing. Well, Jen, we've covered cheese, pizza, ice cream, bed taxes, mass murderers and Princess Anne. I think that's an award-winning podcast interview, personally.
I think we've got quite a recipe for a soap opera with about 3 years' worth of content.
Oh, can you imagine this coming out just as Clause 28 did? We'd be off the air, love. Thank you very much for chatting to me. You can find out more about the Bisexuality Report and about Jen on our website, prideradio.co.uk.
Bisexual Awareness Week on Pride Radio with NHS Business Service Authority.